This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, our first guest this week is a world-class musician who's also a renowned and passionate conservationist. He's Chuck Lavelle, who has spent over three decades playing piano and keyboard with the likes of the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, George Harrison, and many others. He's also a forest conservationist and an environmentalist whose most recent book, Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, and Sustainable, is just out. Chuck was recently at Michigan State University as a guest of the Boone and Crockett Club and the MSU Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Wonderful to be with you, Kurt. Really appreciate the invitation.
Now, you gave a lecture at Michigan State. What were some of the messages or a couple of the key points that you hope resonated with your audience?
Well, I'm not so sure it was a lecture, but, you know, we had so much fun. And the theme of my discussion is stewardship and partnerships. First of all, how important it is that we all be good stewards of our lands and our natural resources. And then secondly, the importance of partnerships in making that go as well as it can.
Now, when we think of partnerships and sustainability, we think pretty broadly these days. But what were some of the things you had to say specifically about the importance of partnerships?
Well, it's interesting because what I like to do is take the Rolling Stones as an example of an enduring partnership and how the guys individually could have left at any time and pursued their own interests, you know, away from the band. But the fact that they've stuck together all this time and still are creative and still making records and still a big draw. And then I kind of compare that to the importance of having strategic – and by the way, it goes beyond just the four Rolling Stones into, you know, what it takes to put a show on. And that's, hey, the guy that designs the lights, the guy that designs the stage, the people that put it all together, the promoters that get involved. You know, it takes everybody to make that show work. And that's what I like to compare in terms of natural resources. It takes everybody working together. You know, it's really interesting. My good friend Mark Ray is who – invited me to come here, and you know, we were working together during his time in Washington, D.C. as Undersecretary of Natural Resources and Agriculture. And during that time in that administration, we saw something phenomenal, and that was, you know, you used to see so many groups that would be at odds with each other, whether it was the U.S. Forest Service and maybe USDA, and then you had, you know, over here the Audubon Society and over here Sierra Club and over here private landowner groups. And they, it used to be difficult to get them in the same room together to get anything done. But then, lo and behold, at some point in time, they started realizing, wait a minute, we need each other. You know, Audubon needs private forests so that we can manage our lands properly and have great areas and habitat for songbirds that they're interested in and so forth. So it is very important that we look and strengthen these strategic partnerships.
Well, that's really interesting because that adversarial relationship that you mentioned that existed back in the 60s and 70s between the so-called environmental groups and then, you know, mainstream society, that has been dissipated. What do you think the major reasons, and I've thought about this a lot over my career, but what is the reason we've gone from this anathema now to more dialogue?
Well, I think it's necessity, really, because we do need each other, you know, and we're stronger if we work together, and we can achieve common goals by working together. But if we're at odds and you know, pointing fingers when things are difficult and not meeting these challenges together, you know, we have to do it. We have – I know we'll get to this, but my current book, Growing a Better America, I talk about how we, at the time I wrote it, we had 310 million people in America. Now that we have 313, and we're just growing exponentially. And, you know, it's just a tremendous amount of pressure on our natural resources. And if we're going to come through this thing all right, it's going to take everybody working together to make it happen.
Chuck, you really got into this in the, I think, late 80s or maybe early 80s. You and your wife inherited some property, I understand, and you turned it into a loblolly and yellow pine plantation, I think. Was that really your first immersion, or had you been thinking about environmentalism for a long time?
Well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and during the cultural revolution that went on at that time, environmentalism was a part of that. And, of course, as we all know, you know, that helped to create the EPA, and it brought forth a lot of changes pollution emissions and so forth. I wasn't a big protester or anything. I didn't go out there and scream and holler about it. But, you know, I paid attention, and these were concerns that I had. And then, of course, I started, my career started taking off and doing pretty well. And some of that, while the ethic of it still was there, I guess the action kind of lay dormant until I met my wife's family. And you have to appreciate, you know, that unbeknownst to me, I was dating the farmer's daughter, you know. And here I was, this rock and roll guy with hair down below my shoulders. And at some point, I had to go meet the farmer and the family. And I was one nervous 20-year-old guy that day, I'll tell you. You know, what happened to me was that the family, number one, they were so gracious to me right from the beginning. And by the way, my wife and I have now been married for 40 years, so it's been a good thing. But what happened was, you know, was I got to know the family and spend time out there walking the woods. I saw the passion, the love, the dedication that they had for the land. It began to rub off on me a little bit. And then, as you mentioned, in 81, Rose Lane inherited about 1,000 acres from her grandmother. Her father had already passed away, so the grandmother left the land to Rose Lane and to her brother. And that's when it really became our responsibility to carry on what we saw as a heritage of stewardship of the land. And so that's how the journey began.
Chuck, over the 20 years, did you become more optimistic or less optimistic about how we're managing our forests in the United States?
Oh, definitely more optimistic. I mean, America is doing a tremendous job in forest management here. You know, as we all know, there was a time when we did not manage so well, and it was kind of a slash and run operation. But we've learned so much since that era. And, you know, we have almost as much or maybe even a little more forest land now as we had 100 years ago. And that's really remarkable. And our state of Georgia has 24 million acres of forest land and does a great, great job. It's also very, very important for jobs in our state. Some 166,000 jobs are directly or indirectly involved in forestry. So it's huge for our state and for the country.
You know, when we used to talk about sustainability and environmentalism, we talked a lot about forest conservation. And, of course, part of that is wildlife conservation. I mean, one of your sponsors at Michigan State was the Boone and Crockett Club, et cetera. But now there's this whole human dimension, too, and this interplay between the natural environment and the human environment, et cetera. And it seems like that may have been a framework for your latest book.
Well, yes, to a degree, absolutely. And you're right, Kurt. All these things go together, don't they? I mean, you're not going to have the wildlife if you're not properly managing your forest lands and your agricultural lands and so forth. It's important that we, as we were saying earlier, that we stand together and work together. Listen, I'm an avid quail hunter. You know, we have a quail hunting component to our business at Charlaine Plantation. I love to hunt. I love to work the dogs. I love to be outdoors. And, so a lot of what I do as a forest manager is in tandem with what I'm doing as a wildlife manager. And we're blessed down there. You know, we have a fantastic population of white-tailed deer. We have the wild turkey have come back in the last 20 years or so. It's just phenomenal. The quail still have some challenges, but we're still, you know, studying and trying to improve their habitat and their numbers. It seems to be somewhat cyclical, but we're blessed with a great population, and I love being out there and seeing those deer and turkey and birds dancing in the woods.
Well, when I was growing up, and maybe this was true for you as well, but this whole term of sustainability science wasn't even in the lexicon. And now we're talking the science and the research and the outreach and the education have become so much more profound in the last maybe 10 or 15 years.
Absolutely, and the technology comes into play as well. You know, in our particular part of Georgia, we have a bear habitat there. It's the smallest bear habitat in the state. There's two other areas. The north part of the state has bear habitat, and then the Okefenokee Swamp. But we're right in the center of the state. We call it Middle Georgia, and we're near the Okmulgee River there. And there's a pretty darn healthy population of black bear there. But getting to your point, there has been innumerable studies. There's one going on now. Sponsored by the University of Georgia and by DOT, because there has been some accidents that have occurred where bear and other animals, as we know, get hit. And so this study is not only to see where the population is and the health of the population, but it's also to see, you know, where do we have these intersections where it's, bears might be injured by vehicles or whatever, and how can we eliminate or at least lower that risk. And one of the things they're looking at is to putting these underpasses where they kind of funnel the bears that need to cross so that they can do it safely.
Another good example, I know you're big into alternative energy as well, and when we put up wind turbines anymore, we have to look at migratory patterns of birds and things of that nature. I mean, 30, 40 years ago, we had to just put the windmills up, irregardless of the birds.
Well, that's right, and you're going to meet all kinds of challenges as we go forward in trying to find, you know, cleaner, greener energy sources and so forth. So we just have to be aware of these things and be clever about it and be smart about it and find ways that we can all make it work.
Well, speaking of cleaner energy and sustainability, your latest book, Growing a Better America, hot off the press, Smart, Strong, and Sustainable. You go well beyond forest conservation in this book and look at many of the dimensions of sustainability. A little bit about the book and what inspired it.
Well, you know, as I give a speech from time to time in which I would use that phrase. I said, look, you know, we're experiencing phenomenal growth, but is the growth that we're going to experience going forward going to be rapid, rampant, and reckless, or can it be smart, strong, and sustainable? And the more I said those words in my presentations, the more I've started focusing on the positive aspect, smart, strong, and sustainable. How can we deal with this phenomenal growth and do it in the right way? And, you know, one of the things we did was point out successes in the book. One in particular that's in sort of in my backyard. It's a little bit south of Atlanta. It's a community called Serenbee, S-E-R-E-N-B-E. And I'll try to make this a short story because it is rather long, but a fellow named Steve Nygren, who was a successful restaurateur, bought a little 20-acre place in the country for a family getaway. And then he enlarged it a little bit to, you know, 30 acres or so. And then one day he and his daughter are out jogging, and they see the bulldozers coming. And he goes, oh, boy, here it comes, you know. And he had this epiphany. He realized, well, I can't stop it, you know, but maybe I can guide it. So he started going around and knocking on his neighbors' doors. He started holding community meetings and just having these discussions. And it took him a long time. But the result was that they put together about 1,000 acres of land. They have a 70-30 ethic of 70% natural lands, 30% development. They have tons of biking trails throughout it. They have an equestrian center. They have a small-scale hotel with a five-star restaurant. All the houses are Earthcraft standard houses, so they're well insulated, so forth. They all have Energy Star appliances in them. They have an organic garden that provides food for three of the restaurants, and also on the weekends has a community aspect to it. So, you know, what a great example. You know, this is healthy lifestyle living. As we all know, we have a health problem in this country. There's obesity and other diabetes and other things that we fight. But if we can have communities where you can be healthy, walk and eat healthy, then, you know, you're going to prevent a lot of that.
Well, I noticed in the book you have sections on smart communities and specifically smart buildings, smart houses, alternative energy, all the things you just mentioned as part of an overall sustainability plan. You know, there's also a lot, too, and I don't need to tell you this, but people who travel the world. I mean, there are countries. There's Europe. There's New Zealand, Costa Rica, other places that are doing some amazing things. We can learn from those people.
We certainly can, and you know, as you would imagine, traveling as we do with the Stones and with other bands that I work with, you get to see a lot of that, and that's another thing that prompted Growing a Better America, is seeing the efforts that we have. Hey, here's an example. You know, I'm a tree farmer. I'm interested in biomass for energy purposes. Well, you're finally starting to see that. You're seeing these pellet plants. They make these pellets out of wood that are used for energy purpose, either to make electricity or to heat homes. And guess what? We're seeing these plants in our state of Georgia and throughout the Southeast, but they're not being used here. They're going across the water to Europe to be used over there. So, you know, so in some ways, they're really ahead of us, and we need to try to do better in this country.
I've got to ask you, you have a chapter in your book about other artists who are doing things for conservation, some of your colleagues. Are there one or two examples you could give us of folks who are doing some amazing things that maybe people were not aware about that are doing these sorts of things?
Well, yes. I think the faces that people would really know would be, you know, even when you look at outside the music field into acting, DiCaprio, Leonardo DiCaprio, has really done some wonderful philanthropic work that has to do with, you know, everything from housing down in New Orleans post-Katrina to environmental work and so forth. I'm trying to think of the artist. Jack Johnson, who is a pretty well-known rock and roll artist, has a passion for surfing and for oceanography issues, and so he's very involved in that. And by the way, he has a wonderful studio that's powered in part by solar. And you know, a lot of the groups these days are using biodiesel when they're touring in their buses, and when they cannot somehow reduce their own carbon footprint, they're buying carbon credits somewhere or planting trees and working with other organizations. The Indigo Girls are a good example of that. Bonnie Raitt is very involved. Jackson Brown. So, and even the Rolling Stones, to a degree, I was able to get them to do a carbon-free tour of Europe on the last big tour that we did there, and that we worked with an organization that helped offset by planting trees.
Well, Chuck, if they want you on the keyboard, then they're going to have to deal with you being an environmental gadfly, right?
Darn right. Chuck, you have to listen to me now.
Well, Chuck, it's been a real pleasure. I've been talking with Chuck Lavelle, who plays keyboard for the Rolling Stones, doing some amazing environmental work as well, out with a new book called Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, and Sustainable. I'm going to order my copy, and you can just Google it. That's probably the easiest way. And for an extra $10, you can get a signature on it as well. But I'm glad you had a great visit to Michigan State University. It's been a real pleasure meeting you and talking with you.
Well, thanks so much. It's an absolute honor for me to be here. Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes a well-known name in Michigan, former legislator, now a partner in the East Lansing-based Byram and Fisk advocacy communications firm, and a member of the MSU Board of Trustees. She is Diane Byram. Diane, welcome back to the program. It's always good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Diane, let's start by talking about a program you're involved in. It's called ALM, or that's the acronym, but it's Agricultural Leaders of Michigan. What is ALM?
Well, ALM is a true coalition of agribusiness and commodity groups. We came together at the end of 2010 to be an independent voice in agriculture that could be pretty nimble and move quickly on issues. ALM consists of eight groups today. They're Greenstone Farm Credit Services, the Michigan Agribusiness Association, Michigan Milk Producers, the Michigan Allied Poultry Industries, the Potato Growers of Michigan, Michigan Pork Producers, Michigan Corn Growers, and the Michigan Soybean Association. So it's really the breadth and depth of Michigan agriculture, and it represents what you think of in terms of Michigan agriculture.
I don't need to tell you this, Diane, but the agriculture has been a really good story, not only in Michigan, but nationally, at least across most commodities. It appears that there's already pretty strong leadership in agriculture. So why the ALM program? Is that to enhance leadership, to develop young leaders? What are the major goals?
Well, the major goals of the ag leaders, it's economic and education focused. You know, we want to support policies that broadly enhance the sector and diversify Michigan's economy. And so what you see with these eight members, they represent the heft of Michigan agriculture. They came together because there are times when agriculture doesn't speak as a monolith. And when that happens, there's an independent voice out there. They're fairly nimble with eight people, and it's the executives of every one of those eight organizations that are part of a coalition. They focus on what brings them together, not what their differences are. So whenever ALM takes a position, it is by unanimous vote. So that's a lot of strength when you have eight of the largest sectors in the state on the agriculture side standing shoulder to shoulder, all in agreement. They can leverage their own individual assets so that they speak louder than any one of them would independently.
So exactly how does the group convene periodically and discuss issues? And they must have some sort of a protocol for coming to consensus.
We do meet on a regular basis. We have a regular meeting schedule. It's every other month. We have an annual meeting of all eight of these boards in August. And we come with an agenda, but there's no president or leader of this group. I serve as a facilitator of the coalition. But any member can bring any item in front of their colleagues, their peers, for discussion. And then if we take a position, we take that with a unanimous vote. So the things that we focus on tend to be pretty big picture. Trade is a big issue for them. Infrastructure broadly. So it's not just about roads and bridges to these folks. It's about railroads. It's about ports so that we can use our waterways to ship product more effectively. It's about utility, access and cost to utilities, mobile broadband, because that's being utilized more and more in agriculture. So it's broad in terms of the issues that they take on. Labor and talent is another issue that is a primary concern. So we tend to take on real big picture items that broadly impact the agricultural sector.
One of those that you mentioned was water, and we talked a little bit about water before we started the interview here. Why is water so important? We understand it's important globally. It's important. Our Great Lakes are a wonderful resource. What about in terms of agriculture?
Well, it is essential to agriculture, and it is becoming a really big deal in Michigan. We are seeing an expansion of water use with center pivots. You're seeing a lot more irrigation. You're seeing some different cropping patterns in Michigan where you're seeing agriculture going further north, largely due to changes in our climate and seed varieties, seed technology and genetics so that you can grow crops farther north. But with that comes more irrigation. Also, water quality is extremely important. So it's important to how you grow crops, how you feed and water livestock, but also as we look at growing an industry here that's very vibrant, water is essential. So the ag leaders are going to be taking some very high-profile positions on water use and water quality.
My guest is Diane Byram, who's a partner in Byram & Fisk Advocacy Communications, an East Lansing-based firm. We're talking about the Agricultural Leaders of Michigan program. Diane, you mentioned the talent and young people coming into agriculture, getting the training, the skills that they need for what is Michigan's second most important industry. Why is that an issue?
Well, in order for the sector to continue to grow, they have to have employees that are ready, trained, and ready to work in the industry. when you take a look at agriculture, you see in certain job classifications that they're at the end of their career, not at the beginning of their career. And agriculture has kind of had a bad rap for a long time. It's seen as low-skilled, low wages. Well, that couldn't be further from the truth. Today, agriculture is very dynamic. It's high tech. It has all different levels of educational requirements and skill sets and job opportunities, and is only getting more technical. So agriculture is kind of grown up. And as it grows up and becomes a much more sophisticated and high-tech industry, it has some growing pains. And so what we're seeing in agriculture is we really need to spend some time looking at job descriptions, skill sets that are necessary against those job descriptions, and then the next step would be to make sure that we have educational slash training programs in place to meet those skill sets. And so we've been working with Michigan State University over at the Product Center and the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources to help with this job description and matching them up with skill sets. Later on this summer, we will have a major announcement. We'll be providing our results and then talking about next steps. And this is a perfect example of how the ag leaders of Michigan can come together, identify an issue, and leverage their individual association to help fill a gap. And so what we've discovered working with MSU is there was no information on the production agriculture side in terms of job descriptions and the skill sets. So we've been working with the Michigan milk producers. They have surveyed their members, both large, middle, and small operators, and they have gotten an overwhelming response, in excess of 80% response rate on surveys. And this is something that no one else was ever able to do, whether you were talking to MEDC or Extension or the local economic development agency, because they didn't have that direct connection and that kind of credibility with the association. So that we have very strong hopes for that project giving us some really good information that is, frankly, critical as we move forward and start to look at workforce.
Historically, a lot of that workforce has been provided by high school agri-science programs, kids, not only high school graduates, but then those kids would go on to college, some of them major in the colleges of Ag and Natural Resources. So is part of this project to expand that awareness among people that may not be from an agricultural background, to make those career opportunities available to people who may not be thinking about them historically?
Absolutely. That's a piece of it. And also workforce issues with workforce development boards as people get retrained and go into different professions. So it's a combination. And again, the jobs that are out there are across the gamut of skill levels too. So part of it is to recruit more young people into the field of agriculture. There's lots of demand for bachelor's and master's and PhD degrees, you know, food science and agronomy and water and how that's utilized and seed genetics. And so there's a whole world of opportunities for students here at Michigan State University across many disciplines, not just in the College of Agriculture. But so until we, though, actually get data and understand what jobs are really out there and what are the requirements to get that job, that's what we need as a basis. And then we're going to be able to go out and talk more about, hey, come look at agriculture. It's a dynamic and exciting field, and you can really make a difference across the world in this profession.
Diane, we are talking about the agricultural leaders of Michigan, and it makes for a nice transition over to some of the things that are going on at Michigan State with respect to Be Spartan Green, sustainability, et cetera. We've covered a lot of those initiatives on this program with folks who are working on the ground at Michigan State University. Frankly, we've never talked about these things with someone on the governing board, the Board of Trustees. When trustees talk sustainability, is it unanimous? Is there a lot of enthusiasm? Are there differing points of view? Take us inside the room a little bit.
Well, I would say the decisions are unanimous. In terms of the enthusiasm, on the surface, everyone is extremely enthused. We're doing some really cool and great things here at the university, and students are involved, so that really gets people's excitement up, living, learning environment. In terms of the knowledge and the education. The Board of Trustees has come a long ways because it's not a subject area that everyone is necessarily real exposed to in their own careers or know a whole lot about. So there's been a lot of education that's gone on at the board level, as well as across the universities and the departments and faculty, support staff, as well as students. So I think all of that is really encouraging because it is the future. We have to make smart use of our natural resources and be good stewards of our land, our air, and our water. And what better place to do that than a land-grant university and involve the students? Not only is it going to be their reality during their lifetime, but there are tremendous career opportunities also and that are going to be evolving and becoming much more relevant to the economy across the board, whether it's in the United States or it's global.
It's probably not as difficult to sell the students on all of this sustainability. I remember President Simon saying once on this program that students come to Michigan State with the expectation that MSU will be green. And if it's not green enough, then they're going to push for greener. As a trustee, have you been impressed by the student passion for some of these issues?
Oh, absolutely. And I have met with many of the student groups. I've spoken to their various meetings and was quite involved in the energy transition plan because I do believe it's not only the right thing, but again, I go back to the land grant history of this university, and Michigan State University should be leading in sustainability and energy transition, and we should make sure that our living environment and our programs at this university reflect that.
Now, this energy transition plan, I've read that. It's impressive. It's also very thoughtful because we're not going to do something tomorrow or the next day. We have, as you know better than I, the economic issues associated with these kinds of. But in broad terms, what does the energy transition plan look like?
Well, it sets aggressive goals. So it sets 25% renewable energy by 2025 and then ratchets it up pretty aggressively in 2030 and 2035 and points the direction to be 100% sustainable. Now, you are correct that it can't be done overnight because there are significant cost factors involved. But it also combines Be Smart and Green so that we reduce some of our use and the costs associated with recycling and with just waste. Mm-hmm. But it also looks at energy efficiency. And the savings from energy efficiency, which are significant and growing, are then put back into the energy transition plan to help pay for that. And as we look at new construction or renovation of our buildings on campus, we make sure that they're LEED and green certified, and we're using multiple kinds of energy systems to get efficiencies and lower cost and be more sustainable and green. So it's all of that in combination that makes it work. And then the economics of energy are changing pretty dramatically. That is allowing Michigan State to make that transition away from coal to natural gas on our way to complete renewable and sustainability much quicker. And so that's all good news. And as energy costs go down on the campus, that gives us more money to put into renovation and energy efficiency and other kinds of and then renewables on campus much faster than we otherwise would be able to.
One of the compelling things and rather unique things about doing these initiatives at a university is that you can also integrate this into the teaching curricula and research programs as well.
And frankly, that was as exciting to me than one of the more exciting parts of the energy transition plan. Yes, absolutely had to move towards more renewable energy, but to integrate that into curriculum and research, that points the way to the future. Because the students on campus today, across many disciplines, are going to be working and involved in industries and sectors dealing with renewable energy, dealing with energy efficiency, researching, whether it's how much water. We go back to agriculture in irrigation. There are seed technologies, genetics, as well as irrigation systems through research and through R&D and even the amount of electricity on irrigation pumps all play into this broader global sustainability conversation. So it can go across many disciplines as we look at how are we going to be smarter in how we use our natural resources, be more efficient, and just better stewards all the way around.
You know, you mentioned for the trustees, for some of the trustees, it's been a bit of an educational process, this whole business of sustainability. But when the university is so closely tied to major corporations like Ford and Coca-Cola, agricultural businesses that are doing wonderful things in sustainability, looking at the private sector, I mean, they've already, in many cases, developed strategies for becoming more sustainable, but also strategies that make money in the process.
Absolutely. And that is the future. It's going to be much less about government regulation and much more about requirements from the market sector on sustainability. And you can see all of the major corporations are requiring sustainability plans for the people that they do business with, reduction of carbon footprint. And you need to document that. Again, that opens a whole array of careers into the future, into the near future, but way into the future, as to how are you going to find ways through to reduce carbon footprint? How are you going to document that so that it's real and that you then can trace that, you know, have a trail so that it can be improved upon?
Yeah, I just read, and you may not have even seen this, Michigan State was selected as a Sustainable 16 finalist for the second March Madness tournament for environmental academics and sustainability.
I did not see that. But
so I don't know if we're going to make it to the Final Four, but at least we're in the Sweet 16, and that's not a bad deal.
That's not a bad deal, and we do a lot of things in sustainability that, you know, one of my biggest criticisms is I don't think we talk about it enough. And across the university, I don't think we talk about all the great things we do enough, because I am just amazed on a regular basis all of the great work, the cool research, the wonderful students and what they're engaged in that goes on in this university that, you know, we here really take it for granted, but we don't share our great story enough outside of our borders.
Well, you can be assured, Diane, that when we have guests like you on the program, Greening of the Great Lakes is doing its best to spread that good news. I've been talking with Diane Byram, former Michigan legislator, partner in the East Lansing-based Byram and Fisk Advocacy Communications Firm, also a member of the MSU Board of Trustees. Diane, best of luck with Agricultural Leaders of Michigan and continued success on the MSU Board of Trustees.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class. Four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Chasing Ice is a riveting documentary film that dramatically chronicles the impact of climate change on our Arctic glaciers. Chasing Ice will be coming to Michigan State University for a special showing on Thursday, April the 25th, beginning at 7 p.m. at Wells Hall. The airing of Chasing Ice at MSU is sponsored by the MSU Department of Geography, and it is indeed a pleasure to speak with the director of Chasing Ice, Jeff Orlowski, who joins us from his Colorado home. Jeff, thanks so much for taking some time to talk about the documentary.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me on the show.
Early in the documentary, award-winning photographer James Balog says that the climate change story is in the ice. What did he mean by that?
That interview came from a shoot that we did back in 2007. And James was really trying to figure out how to make climate change visible, because it's inherently invisible. You're talking about temperature and carbon dioxide changes. And he's trying to figure out how can he photograph it, how can he document it. And he realized that the place on the planet that was changing the most as a result of climate change were these glaciers. And that's where he could see it, and that's where he could photograph the story. So for him, it was all about the ice.
Jeff, you have a Stanford University pedigree. You hooked up on this project, I think, back in 2007. Tell us a little bit about how you established your relationship with James and how that led to this film.
I had met James through a mutual friend, and I really just wanted to work with him on any photographic project that he was doing. I had a background in still photography, and that's what my interest was at the time. And when James was going to Iceland for the very first trip, I was able to join and shoot video, and that was how I was, you know, offering my services to tag along, was by shooting video. And on the next trip he did to Greenland, I came to that, and when he went to Alaska, I kept traveling with him, and we kept filming everything without really the purpose of making a movie. The intention was really just to document his story and to capture footage and have an archive and have a record of imagery just for whatever purposes we may need. It wasn't until about a year and a half into the project that we actually decided we were going to make a film.
Now, that first trip that you took with him to Iceland, I think that was the Solheim Glacier, perhaps, if I remember correctly. What were your initial impressions when you started taking these photographs?
That's a good question. It's interesting because my experience at that point was a little bit different from James. He had been to that glacier a couple times already, and he was seeing how much this landscape had changed. And when I got there, I could hear the stories of, oh, the glacier was back here 6 months ago, or, oh, the glacier was over there a year ago. And it definitely has an impact when you're in a landscape and you can see a post in the ground that says, this is where the glacier used to be, and it had retreated, you know, 20 feet or 50 feet or 100 feet since then. But it wasn't until my second trip back to those locations until it really hits you, when you can actually see how much the landscape has changed. And that really was the beautiful thing about what James was doing with the time lapses. You weren't just seeing a before and after of where the glacier started and where the glacier ended. You're actually seeing the process of the glacier disappearing, of it retreating. And that's really the emotional part. That's the impactful part of the imagery, to see the process of climate change in action.
The images are spectacular. The art forms of that ice as it was and as it was melting, frankly, amazing. But say a little bit about the technology. How are all these images captured in such harsh climates?
The main idea for the project was to do time lapses of glaciers all around the world. And James's concept was to take a still photo camera, to mount it up against bedrock, up against a wall or something like that, and just have it pointed there and have it self-sustainable. It's running on solar power with a car battery, and it has a custom timer, and it's telling the system to take a picture every hour of daylight. Now they actually take photographs every half hour of daylight. We've increased the speed of them. And the cameras now have been out there in some cases for 6 years since the installations in March of 2007. So they're still shooting. They're continuing to document the changes. There are about 30 cameras that are still out in the field right now shooting every half hour of daylight. And it's just keeping this ongoing record.
My guest is Jeff Orlowski, who is the director of Chasing Ice. The placement of those cameras in Iceland, Greenland, and these other really cold, frigid climates must have been harrowing at times.
Yes, it was. In retrospect, there were a lot of risky moments, I guess. But the reality of it was that that was what was really fun for us. You know, James, he's a mountaineer. He's an explorer. I had a strong background in climbing and rock climbing and camping. I think everybody on the team was very comfortable outdoors, and we enjoyed that part. The risks were known, and we always felt very comfortable with them. So we kept safety as a high priority on all the trips, and it was something where we knew that there were risks inherent to it, but we kept them under control as best as possible.
Now, when you and James and others who are involved decided to make take all of these images, all these time lapse photographs, and put them into a film, I imagine trying to decide what to put in and what to leave out was incredibly difficult.
Certainly, it was probably the most difficult process for the whole project was the editing of the movie for me. It's something where we had over 400 hours of footage, and we had over 1 million photographs on the time-lapse record. And culling that down to 75 minutes, just by definition, is pretty tough. But really, we tried to keep it focused on a story and on James's story. And fortunately, we had so much footage of all the adventures out in the field that we had a lot of footage to choose from. There were a number of times when we were in the editing phase where the editor and I, we needed a scene that conveyed James having difficulty with the camera, or James having successes with the camera, or James, you know, doing a variety of different things. And we would look through the footage, and we would recognize that we had scenes from a lot of different places. Do we want to show James struggling with the camera in Alaska or in Greenland or Iceland? And it was really, really fortunate on the editing side that we had that much stuff to work with.
Let's turn to the song that kicks off the documentary, Before My Time, which was nominated in the Best Original Song category in this year's Oscar nominations. The lyrics were by Jay Ralph, and it was performed by Scarlett Johansson and Joshua Bell. A beautiful and hauntingly melodic song. How did you hook up with Jay Ralph? How did you decide to do that?
Yeah, the composer, Josh Ralph, has worked with Paula, my producer, on a different project, The Cove. So we had a relationship with him already, and when we were getting ready to talk about music for Chasing Ice, we were thinking of a couple composers, and I started listening to Josh's work and just completely fell in love with it and knew that this was a really good route for us to go. I met with him in New York, and we started talking about style and songs, and it was just a really great fit. And when we started talking about the end credits and what we wanted to do there, he had recognized that that having vocals would be valuable and important in there, and we were talking about a lot of different singers that could potentially perform it. And he said Scarlett's name, and I wasn't really familiar with her singing, and he started playing for me some stuff that he had recorded of her, and the tone was just perfect. And he said that he could possibly get her to record the end credits for us. So it all just worked out really, really well, and it's been a huge success, and we're all thrilled for Josh for having the song get nominated.
Well, Jeff, we're certainly looking forward to, I guess you're coming to Michigan State yourself for that airing of Chasing Ice on April 25th.
Yep, so I'll be out there doing a Q&A after the screening and hopefully being able to answer any questions that everybody has.
And if there's one reason people should come and see this film from your perspective from 50,000 feet, what is it?
Well, there are a lot of reasons to see the film, but it's even more important to see it on a big screen. And the main reason for that is that the landscape, the glaciers, are huge. And seeing it on a big screen is the only real way you can get any sort of sense of the scale of these places. They are the largest landscapes I've ever experienced. I haven't seen anything in the lower 48 states that compares to the vastness of Greenland. And it really is an experience to see the imagery of the glaciers on a big screen. I think that's critical to Chasing Ice.
And all the other important reasons for seeing it, as well as you mentioned, with respect to climate change and what we're doing for sustainability of our planet. But, Jeff, I thank you for your time. We're certainly looking forward to Chasing Ice coming to Michigan State University Thursday, April 25th. It airs at 7 p.m. in Wells Hall. It's sponsored by the MSU Department of Geography. I've been talking with the director of Chasing Ice, Jeff Orlowski. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please visit Greening of the Great Lakes online at mlive.com/environment.
The program is MSU Today. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with some observations from the Spartan life. We love our comfort zones. Even an uncomfortable status quo is preferable to the unknown. But things change. We outgrow a job, or the job outgrows us. Our relationship ends. A health crisis appears. Or the sting of an unhappy current reality becomes so great that we are forced to step outside of our self-imposed boundaries. This is one of life's great ironies. We often fight to stay inside the box when the very thing we need to fuel our future lies on the outside. This week, make a list of the things that are keeping you inside your comfort zone. How many of them are self-imposed? Every single one. The next chapter of your life's adventure will be written with or without your direct involvement. Maybe it's time to imagine what that chapter might be if your uncomfortable comfort zone didn't exist. As I was researching this week's message, I discovered this anonymous poem, which I've customized just for you. I hope it gets you thinking about those self-imposed limitations and the opportunities that lie beyond them. I used to have a comfort zone where I knew I wouldn't fail. The same four walls and busy work were really more like jail. I longed so much to do the things I'd never done before, but stayed inside my comfort zone and paced the same old floor. I didn't want to build the traits successful people share. I watched my friends advance and thrive, pretending not to care. I claimed to be so busy with the things inside the zone, but deep inside, I longed for something special of my own. I couldn't let my life go by just watching others grow. I held my breath, I stepped outside, and let the changes flow. I took a step, and with new strength I'd never felt before, I kissed my comfort zone goodbye and closed and locked the door. If you're in a comfort zone, afraid to venture out, remember that our heroes were at one time filled with doubt. A step or two and words of praise can make your dreams come true. Reach for your future with a smile. Happiness is there for you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.